Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this episode we explore the crimes of that peculiar subset of murderers, the poisoners. We begin with a classic among poisoners, the teapot killer Graham Young, a demented Englishman who began his deadly hobby of poisoning as a child and killed for no other reason than he enjoyed it. We conclude this episode with the story of Ronald O'Brien, better known as the man who ruined Halloween because he murdered his own son with poison trick-or-treat candy.
The Teacup Poisoner. Poison is a particularly nefarious means of murder. It is usually gradual, secretive, and painful. It requires a conscious effort on the part of the murderer who administers the means of death over a specific period of time while observing the effects of the murder weapon on the hapless victim. Despite its popularity in the Golden Age of Rome and Renaissance Italy, it was considered a coward's way to kill because of the anonymity it allowed. Death by poison is usually slow torture for the victim. Even the most fast-acting poisons require some time to work. More often, exposure to a fatal dose of poison requires time and repeated application. A single dose may cause illness, but subtlety is important to avoid detection, and simply dropping a lethal amount of strychnine in someone's coffee is likely to raise the eyebrows of either the intended victim, the police, or both. Poisoners are frequently the most demented of murderers, comparable to the last murderers in their cruelty. Although there is normally a motive other than simply watching someone die, poisoners usually take some degree of pleasure in watching their victim suffer and die. Most frequent motives of poisoners are monetary gain, followed by the overpowering need to be rid of a hated someone. Munchausen by proxy syndrome, where a person causes someone in their care to become ill so that the person can gain attention or demonstrate heroics, is also a common explanation for poisoning another. Less frequently seen, but the most disturbing motive of all, is simple curiosity. Killing for the sake of killing is not unheard of, but senseless murder is probably the most cruel of all. Combine murder for its own sake with slow torture and you create pure evil. Such is the case of British poisoner Graham Young, who killed for the sake of watching his victim die. Without doubt a psychopath, Young viewed poisoning as an academic exercise. He selected his victims, administered his poisons, and measured the results, much like a scientist conducting an experiment. Killers like Graham Young are born, not made, although he was subjected to an unusual family situation that perhaps impacted his ability to form relationships. He was born in 1947 and never knew his mother, who died when he was but 3 months old. His overwrought father was unable to care for Graham and his sister, and they were farmed out to relatives. For the first 2 years of his life, Graham lived with his aunt and uncle and bonded with them as a normal child would to its caregivers. When his father remarried in 1950, Graham was taken from the only home he ever knew and reunited with his father and a new stepmother. The separation significantly affected the toddler, who became distant and unable to play with other children. Graham was a bright child who shunned the typical interests of his peers in favor of true crime stories. Reportedly, the famous poisoner Dr. Horley Crippen was one of his heroes. As a teen, he became an apologist for Adolf Hitler, whom he thought was simply misunderstood. In his early teen years, Graham demonstrated the textbook signs of a violent psychopath. His first targets were the neighborhood cats, which disappeared at an alarming rate when he was around. Some reports say that Graham was also interested in necromancy and tried to induce the neighborhood children to join him in improvised occult rites. More likely, Graham staged the rites, which usually involved animal sacrifice, to get pleasure from the shock and horror of the witnesses. Perhaps it was a serendipitous event that introduced Graham to his weapon of choice, as things started to go really bad when, as a young teenager, Graham was given a chemistry set by his father. Graham was a natural chemist who consumed literature about the science with ravenous attention. Making friends with local pharmacists, Graham was able to circumvent British poison laws and obtain deadly amounts of poisons like arsenic, belladonna, and antimony. He quickly put the poisons to use, giving his sister a dose of belladonna in her tea as she headed off to school, November 1961. She began to suffer visual distortions and was taken to the hospital where the nightshade was discovered. Graham's father reportedly suspected his son, but was unable to convince himself that a young boy would deliberately try to harm a person in such a way. A schoolmate of Graham's was also subjected to a potentially lethal poison cocktail, leading to severe cramps, vomiting, and other nasty symptoms. His doctors were baffled by the untraceable illness. After all, no one suspected deliberate poisoning. Investigators believe the only thing that saved the boy's life was that Graham was unable to continue to administer the poison after the boy became bedridden. He eventually recovered. Soon 14-year-old Graham began his deadly experiments in earnest, targeting his family. The entire young household became ill, including Graham. Whether his own illness was to avert suspicion or was the result of poor planning isn't known. He chose inorganic heavy metals which are particularly insidious. They are just as lethal as the organics like hemlock, belladonna, also called nightshade, monk's hood, etc., but poisons like antimony, arsenic, strychnine, and thallium are often more slower-acting and more agonizing to the victim. In April 1962, Graham's stepmother, Molly, was discovered balled up and writhing in pain in the family's backyard. Graham's father came upon his wife in her agony and saw Graham standing over her observing the scene like a scientist would watch an experiment. Molly died in the hospital that night. At Graham's suggestion, she was cremated. Later he told authorities that she had developed a resistance to the antimony he was giving her, so he switched to a large dose of thallium to finish her off. Within days of the funeral, Graham's father began suffering symptoms similar to his wife and he was admitted to the hospital and diagnosed with antimony poisoning. Again, he refused to accept the idea that his son was a psychopathic poisoner. However, when a teacher in Graham's school discovered a cache of poisons and books on poisoning in Graham's desk, police were called in and Graham was quickly arrested. The poisons in his possession were evidence enough, but authorities were shocked at the young teen's knowledge of poison and its effects. In 1962, Graham was adjudicated as criminally responsible, yet mentally ill, and sent to Broadmoor, Britain's Hospital for the Criminally Insane, where he was supposed to spend a minimum of 15 years. Behind the walls of Broadmoor, Graham continued his violent ways and claimed to have killed at least one inmate with cyanide. Strange illnesses and contaminated foods were common occurrences once Graham was admitted to Broadmoor. Graham was released in 1971 and labeled as cured. In hindsight, it is incredible that something like that could happen, but Graham was an intelligent psychopath. He knew what the doctors wanted to hear and was more than happy to say the lines. Graham, now 23, was far from cured. Awaiting release, he told a Broadmoor nurse that he intended to kill one person for each year he had been incarcerated. The threat was noted in his file, but it had no bearing on his release, without supervision. He quickly went to work. While living at a hostel, he poisoned at least two people, one of whom eventually took his own life. Some suspect that he committed suicide because of the intolerable pain he was suffering. Graham settled in Bovingdon, a town northwest of London, taking a job as an office assistant at a photography supply firm, a place where he would have ample access to chemicals. His employers knew he had spent some time at Broadmoor, but the place was not just a place for the criminally insane, it was a mental hospital for more benign purposes. They did not suspect that they had invited a homicidal maniac among them. It did not take long for Graham to get down to the business at hand. His first victim was 59-year-old Bob Eagle, his supervisor at the firm. Initially, when Bob came down with an illness marked by back pain and constant vomiting, his family, friends, and co-workers put it down as the Bovingdon bug, a particularly virulent flu that had been circulating in the community. But had they thought more about it, they might have seen that the bug was confined mostly to school children, not men approaching retirement. Bob Eagle died in agony of his mysterious illness on July 19, 1971. Doctors diagnosed Guillain-Barré syndrome, where the immune system attacks the nerves of the body, as the cause. Back at the photo supply firm, Graham demonstrated an unusual knowledge of medicine connected to disorders like Guillain-Barré. He knew that the syndrome effectively paralyzed the victim and respiratory arrest was a frequent cause of death. Although that caused some curiosity among his co-workers, it did not arise suspicion. It's the bug again. The employee said when 56-year-old Fred Biggs fell ill that October. Biggs felt symptoms similar to Eagles but recovered somewhat when he went home to rest. He returned to work and gratefully accepted a cup of tea from his co-worker, Graham Young. Biggs did not know it, but with Graham's help, he had been slowly building up a toxic amount of thallium in his body, to the point where any antidote would be ineffective. That night after work, Graham recorded a chilling note in his diary. I have administered a fatal dose of the special compound to F and anticipate a report of his progress on Monday, 1st November, he wrote. Fred Biggs was a tough man, but there was nothing to be done for him. On November 1, 1971 he was sick in bed, where he would linger for 19 agonizing days. The time was horrible for Fred Biggs and his family, but it was irritating for Graham. He is surviving too long for my peace of mind, he wrote in one journal entry. By this time the staff at the photo supply firm had noticed that Graham was taking an excessive interest in the state of Fred Biggs's death agony. He liked to share blow-by-blow accounts of what was happening to Fred in the hospital and took pains to point out that Fred's illness was following a similar path to that of Bob Eagles. It is better that he should die, Graham wrote. It will be a merciful release for him, as if he should survive he will be permanently impaired. On November 19, Fred Biggs died. Absenteeism due to illness was up at the firm, and employees were concerned that something was amiss in the handling of the chemicals at the plant. Others thought that there might be a plague in the plant and that someone was a carrier. Symptoms included hair loss, sexual impotence, violent cramps, and stomach ailments. In an effort to reassure the workers that nothing was wrong at the plant, the management invited in a medical team to examine the site and address employee concerns. One of the first steps the team took was to gather employees together to answer their questions. Graham's ego would eventually lead to his downfall. He dominated the Q&A, asking if the doctor thought the symptoms of the mystery illness were consistent with thallium poisoning. Eventually Graham's odd behavior prompted the management to go to the police who began looking into his background. He was arrested 2 days after Fred Biggs died. He reveled in the media attention given to his case and remained confident that he would win acquittal. After all, Graham reasoned, there were plenty of people at the plant who had access to thallium, a common component of photographic processes. That might have been true, but no one else at the plant had diaries admitting the administration of thallium to now-dead co-workers, nor had anyone else been incarcerated for poisoning relatives. After a 10-day trial, Graham Young was found guilty of 2 counts of murder and multiple counts of attempted murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. While in prison he developed a friendship with another prominent killer, Ian Brady, who shared Graham's admiration for Hitler. Young died in prison in August 1990. He was 42. The official cause of death was heart failure, but there remains speculation that he poisoned himself. The man who ruined Halloween. What makes Ronald Clark O'Brien particularly evil is that he was willing to kill at least 5 children to cover his tracks, and that it didn't matter to him which child of his died, they were all equally injured. In fact, the best outcome for him was that they both would succumb. And on a much lesser scale, O'Brien can be partly credited with ruining trick or treat for everyone by making parents paranoid that some maniac is going to put poison in the Halloween candy. In his feeble defense, O'Brien repeatedly denied that he killed his son or put the cyanide in the Halloween candy, and he had plenty of character witnesses who were shocked when he was arrested for his crime. Active in his Baptist church, O'Brien was described by his shocked pastor as a good Christian man, an above-average father. Neighbors concurred. Until I hear his own statement that he did it, I'll never believe it, one told an Associated Press reporter. There has to be a foul-up somewhere. I don't feel that he could do that at all. But his final statement before he was put to death leaves unanswered the question of whether or not he admitted his guilt. If his final words were an admission of guilt, then he failed miserably. What is about to transpire in a few moments is wrong, he wrote in a statement. However, we as human beings do make mistakes and errors. This execution is one of those wrongs, yet it doesn't mean our whole system of justice is wrong. There is no doubt that O'Brien fatally poisoned his son. His plan to kill his children and collect some insurance money was so pathetically planned that poor Timothy O'Brien was hardly laid to rest before his father was jailed for the crime. The best we can come up with for motive is money. There is some indication that the O'Brien family was financially troubled, but there is also evidence that Ronald just wanted to live a nicer life thanks to the insurance proceeds. Shortly before the crime, the O'Brien family had downgraded its living situation and the family budget had just an $11 reserve at the end of the month. Another story reported that Ronald planned to give some of the insurance money to a friend to go to the seminary. It really doesn't matter. There is no excuse for killing one's own children. The murder of Timothy O'Brien by his father was planned weeks in advance of that Halloween night of 1974. On October 2nd, O'Brien phoned a friend in the insurance business and asked about insuring his two children, Timothy, 8, and Timothy's sister, at the time 5 years old. The insurance agent didn't know it, but O'Brien had already insured the children through a savings plan at his bank. The plan provided a $10,000 accidental death policy for the head of a household who had a checking account with the bank. The premium was $3 per month. Additional family members authorized to use the account could also be insured for an extra $1 each. We didn't have that much money, Daneen O'Brien testified at her husband's trial. I thought it was foolish to have two small children on a checking account and have that much insurance on them. When O'Brien sought the additional $20,000 insurance for each of his children, the agent tried to steer him toward a college savings plan that would allow the children to redeem the policy to use the money for their education. O'Brien insisted on the traditional accidental death insurance policies despite the higher premiums. He also raised red flags when he insisted on paying for those particular policies with cash rather than by check as he did for other policies. The prosecutor in the case assumed that O'Brien did so in order to hide the insurance from his wife. In fact, Daneen O'Brien testified that she did not know of the other insurance policies until the day after Timothy died. At the same time he was insuring the children, O'Brien was also seeking the weapon for their deaths. He worked as an optician, making glasses for a large optical company in Houston. Through his work, O'Brien knew that cyanide had been used to polish gold frames, but the technique had been replaced by safer methods in the last decade or so. He spoke to several people about purchasing cyanide, telling co-workers that he was interested in learning the old polishing method. The state was able to prove that O'Brien spoke to at least 12 people about cyanide, including asking one chemist friend about the amount of cyanide needed to kill a person. What the state could never establish was where and how O'Brien got the cyanide. Prosecutors could, however, provide a witness who saw O'Brien carrying a stapler and a bag about the size one would need for the giant Pixie Sticks candy. The state was also able to establish that the Pixie Sticks manufacturer never used staples to seal the plastic tubes. Instead, the candy maker used heat sealing to avoid contamination. Halloween night 1974 was cool and rainy in Deer Park, Texas, but though the drizzle may have required the witches and fairies and pirates prowling the suburban streets to wear raincoats, it did not diminish the excitement of the evening. Jim Bates, a close friend of O'Brien's, arranged the night's festivities. The families started off with a dinner of pork roast and beans, and then the two fathers gathered flashlights and raincoats to take the children, Timothy and his younger sister, and Bates's 9 and 11-year-old kids, trick-or-treating. The children were very excited, Bates recalled later. They were running from door to door. They would shout trick-or-treat. There wasn't really any tricking, they were enjoying it so much. Toward the end of the adventure, the children went up to a dark house but received no response. Bates said he watched them run from the porch to the next house. After a brief pause, O'Brien stepped down from the porch, holding purple and white plastic tubes. "You must have rich neighbors," he said to Bates. "Look what they gave out." O'Brien showed the giant pixie sticks to the children, but kept them in his hand until the troop reached the Bates home. He put the candy on the coffee table. There were five of them, Bates recalled. "He handed one to me, one to my brother, and one to each of his children, and there was one left," Bates's daughter testified at O'Brien's trial. The doorbell rang and there were some trick-or-treaters. O'Brien gave the extra pixie sticks to one of them. "I came within just a whisker of losing both of my children," Bates testified. After the evening's adventure was over, Bates's son took a bath and then told his mother that he was going to enjoy the pixie sticks.
"No you not," his mother replied. "I don't want it all over the house. That's an outside candy."
The random child who was given the fifth pixie sticks also dodged death by a twist of fate. The boy's father related how his son had come downstairs at 9:10 and went into the kitchen in search of a knife to open the pixie sticks. His bedtime was 9:00 that night because of school the following day, his father said. "I told him that he couldn't have it because it was too late. He went back upstairs and set it with the rest of his candy." Over at the duplex where the O'Briens lived, the children were allowed to choose one candy to eat before going to bed. Timothy chose the pixie sticks. O'Brien helped Timothy open the pixie sticks and watched as the boy poured some of the cyanide-laced candy into his mouth. Timothy then complained that the candy had hardened and that no more would come out. O'Brien took the plastic tube and rolled it between his hands, loosening the candy. Then, according to his first statement to police, he poured it down the child. Timothy quickly complained about the bitter taste of the candy and was given some Kool-Aid. Shortly after, he vomited and then went into convulsions. An ambulance was called and Timothy was taken to the hospital where he died. According to his wife, O'Brien barely acted the part of the shocked and distraught parent. "He didn't seem upset," she testified about O'Brien's appearance before their son died.
"I did not see any tears."
When the couple was informed that Timothy was dead, O'Brien hit the wall and questioned out loud, "Why did an 8-year-old have to die?" Returning home from the hospital, O'Brien dropped off his wife and daughter and told them he wanted to be alone. "He said he just had to be alone and rolled the windows up and screamed," she testified. Once the police were informed of the death, an all-out effort was made to alert parents that someone had handed out poisoned Halloween candy. The story went viral in a 1970s fashion, and within days the O'Brien family was known around the country. Once again, O'Brien played the part of a grieving father. He told one newspaper reporter how Timothy had once witnessed Christ before his first grade class. "He stood up in front of all the children and the teacher said that it was so wonderful that she didn't have the heart to stop him," he said. "He was all boy, he loved football, basketball, anything, he never met a stranger, but I have my peace in knowing Tim is in heaven now," O'Brien managed to say with a straight face. At a Sunday service after Timothy's funeral, O'Brien stood amid the congregation and sang a version of the hymn Blessed Assurance, paraphrasing the refrain, "This was Tim's story, this was Tim's song, praising his Savior all the day long." "There wasn't a dry eye in the church when he was through," a member of the congregation said. "He had the entire church in a very emotional state, that this man was so strong in his faith and his convictions that he could do this." O'Brien wasn't really that strong. Obviously police wanted to know where the children got the poisoned pixie sticks from and O'Brien was the link. At first he told investigators that he could not identify which house had distributed the candy, or who handed it out. By November 2nd, at which time the story had spread nationally, the police were leaning on O'Brien pretty hard. He needed to give them a suspect, and that's where he finally tripped up. He managed to locate the house and gave authorities a detailed description of the man who handed out the candy.
Police escorted him through the neighborhood and he pointed out Courtney Melvin as the man who gave him the poisoned pixie sticks for the children. Unfortunately for O'Brien, Melvin easily proved that he was at work at Hobby Airport near Houston until 10:30 p.m. on Halloween night, and the women who were at the Melvin home that night forgot to buy candy and were not answering the door. That misfire led to a polygraph test for O'Brien, which he failed. All that was left was to tie up a few loose ends, and then the state had a pretty open and shut case against Ronald Clark O'Brien. At the end, the few people who cared about O'Brien were mostly anti-death penalty advocates who weren't really interested in the particulars of his case, a few surviving family members, and a Texas A&M student who had been his pen pal for the last 6 months of his life. A few pro-death penalty advocates wore Halloween masks outside the Huntsville prison where O'Brien was the second Texan to die by lethal injection on the last day of March 1984.
We hope you have enjoyed this edition of the Malefactors Register podcast. These true crime stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Barnes and certain musical selections were composed by Justin R. Urban. I'm Rachel Johnson. For more true crime stories on the web, visit markgribben.com. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. Until next time, goodbye.